This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Wildfire, written by Nelson DeMille and read by Scott Brick. Following this program is a special conversation between Scott Brick and Nelson DeMille.
To Bob and Joan Dillingham, who have such lovely daughters. Author's note. When fact and fiction are combined in novels, it's not always clear to the reader which is which. Early readers of the manuscript for Wildfire have asked me what is real and what is a figment of my imagination, so I thought I'd address that here. First, the Anti-Terrorist Task Force, ATTF, represented in this and other John Corey stories, is based primarily on the actual Joint Terrorist Task Force, JTTF. With some literary license taken. In this book specifically, there is a lot of information on ELF, which is an acronym for something you'll discover in the story. All the information about ELF is accurate, to the best of my knowledge. As for the secret government plan called Wildfire, this is based on some information I've come across, mostly online, and can be taken as rumor, fact, pure fiction, or some blend thereof. I personally believe that some variation of Wildfire, by another code name, actually exists, and if it doesn't, it should. Other subjects in the book that people have asked me about, such as NEST, NECAP, and other acronyms, are factual. If what you're reading sounds real, it probably is. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction, and often scarier. The most frequently asked question I've gotten so far is, are bear bangers real? Yes, they are. The time period of this story is October 2002, a year and a month after 9/11/01, and the New York Times headlines and stories I use are real. Similarly, any mention of government security procedures, or lack of same, was true as of the time the story is set. A few of my readers who work in law enforcement think that Detective John Corey has some problems with the limits of his power and his jurisdictional authority. I admit to taking some dramatic liberties for the sake of entertainment. A John Corey who plays by the rules and goes by the book is not what any of us wants in a hero. Early readers of this book have told me that Wildfire kept them awake long after they put the book down. Indeed. This is a scary book for scary times, but it's also a cautionary tale for a post-9/11 world. Part 1. Friday, New York City. The FBI investigates terrorism-related matters without regard to race, religion, national origin, or gender. Terrorism in the United States. FBI Publications. 1997. Chapter 1. I'm John Corey, former NYPD homicide detective, wounded in the line of duty, retired on three-quarter disability, which is just a number for pay purposes. About 98% of me still functions, and now working as a special contract agent for the Federal Anti-Terrorist Task Force. The guy in the cubicle facing me, Harry Muller, asked, "You ever hear of the Custer Hill Club?" "No." "Why?" "That's where I'm going this weekend." "Have a good time," I said. "They're a bunch of rich, right-wing loonies who have this hunting lodge upstate. Don't bring me any venison, Harry. No dead birds, either." I got up from my desk and walked to the coffee bar. On the wall above the coffee urns were Justice Department wanted posters, featuring mostly Muslim gentlemen, including the number one scumbag, Osama bin Laden. Also included in the nearly two dozen posters was a Libyan named Assad Khalil, a.k.a. the Lion. I didn't need to memorize this man's photo. I knew his face as well as my own, though I'd never formally met him. My brief association with Mr. Khalil occurred about 2 years ago when I was stalking him, and as it turned out, he was stalking me. He escaped, and I got away with a grazing wound. And, as the Arabs would probably say, it is destined that we meet again to settle our fates. I look forward to that. I drained the dregs of the coffee into a styrofoam cup and scanned a copy of the New York Times lying on the counter. The headline for today, Friday, October 11th, 2002, read, Congress authorizes Bush to use force against Iraq, creating a broad mandate. A subheading read, U.S. has a plan to occupy Iraq, officials report. It appeared that war was a foregone conclusion, and so was the victory. Therefore, it was a good idea to have an occupation plan. I wondered if anyone in Iraq knew about this. I took my coffee back to my desk, turned on my computer, and read through some internal memos. We are now a mostly paperless organization, and I actually miss initialing memos. I had an urge to initial my computer screen with a grease pencil, but I settled for the electronic equivalent. If I ran this organization, all memos would be on an etch-a-sketch. I glanced at my watch. It was 4:30 p.m., and my colleagues on the 26th floor of 26 Federal Plaza were dwindling fast. My colleagues, I should explain, are, like me, members of the Anti-Terrorist Task Force, a four-letter agency, ATTF, in a world of three-letter agencies. This is the post-9/11 world, so weekends are, in theory, just another two workdays for everyone. In reality, the honored tradition of Federal Friday, meaning cutting out early, has not changed much. So the NYPD, who were part of the task force, and who were used to lousy hours anyway, manned the fort on weekends and holidays. Harry Muller asked me, "What are you doing this weekend?" This was the start of the Columbus Day three-day weekend, but as luck would have it, I was scheduled to work on Monday. I replied, "I was going to march in the Columbus Day parade, but I'm working Monday." "Yeah? You were gonna march?" "No, but that's what I told Captain Parisi." I added, "I told him my mother was Italian and I was going to push her wheelchair in the parade." Harry laughed and asked, "Did he buy that?" "No, but he offered to push her wheelchair." "I thought your parents were in Florida." "They are." "And your mother's Irish." "She is. Now I have to find an Italian mother for Parisi to push up Columbus Avenue." Harry laughed again and went back to his computer. Harry Muller, like most of the NYPD in the Mideast section of the task force, does stakeouts and surveillance of persons of interest, which, in politically correct speak, means the Muslim community. But I do mostly interviewing and recruiting of informants. A large percentage of my informants are total liars and bullshit artists who want either money or citizenship, or who want to screw someone in their close-knit community. Now and then, I get the real deal, but then I have to share the guy with the FBI. The task force comprises mostly FBI agents and NYPD detectives, plus retired NYPD like me. In addition, we have people assigned from other federal agencies, such as Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, plus state and suburban police, Port Authority police, and so forth, too numerous to name or for me to remember. Also included in our collegial group are people who, like ghosts, don't actually exist, but if they did, they'd be called CIA. I checked my email and there were three messages. The first was from my boss, Tom Walsh, special agent in charge, who had taken over the ATTF when my old boss, Jack Koenig, died in the World Trade Center. The email read, "Confidential. Reminder. In the run-up to possible hostilities with Iraq, we need to give special attention to Iraqi nationals living in CONUS." CONUS meant Continental United States. Hostilities meant war. The rest of it meant, find an Iraqi we can link to a terrorist threat against the U.S. so we can make life easier for the folks in Washington before they bomb the shit out of Baghdad. The message went on, Primary threat and emphasis remains UBL, with new emphasis on UBL-Saddam link. Briefing on this next week, TBA. Walsh, SAC. For the uninitiated, UBL is Osama bin Laden, which should be OBL, but long ago somebody transliterated the Arabic script into Latin letters as Usama, which is also correct. The media mostly uses the Osama spelling of the scumbag's name, while intelligence agencies still refer to him as UBL. Same scumbag. The next email was from my second boss, the aforementioned Vince Parisi, an NYPD captain assigned to the ATTF to keep an eye on the difficult cops who sometimes don't play well with their FBI friends. That may include me. Captain Parisi replaced Captain David Stein, who, like Jack Koenig, was killed. Murdered, actually. 1 year and 1 month ago today, in the World Trade Center. David Stein was a great guy, and I miss him every day. Jack Koenig, for all his faults and for all our problems with each other, was a professional, a tough but fair boss, and a patriot. His body was never recovered. Neither was David Stein's. Another body that was never recovered, along with 2,000 others, was that of Ted Nash, CIA officer, monumental prick, and archenemy of yours truly. I wish I could think of something nice to say about this asshole, but all I can think of is good riddance. Also, this guy has a bad habit of coming back from the dead. He's done it at least once before. And without a positive body identification, I'm not breaking out the champagne. Anyway, Captain Parisi's email to all NYPD ATTF personnel read, "You are to step up surveillance of Iraqi nationals. Reach out to Iraqis who have been helpful in the past and bring in for questioning Iraqis on watch lists. You are to pay special attention to Iraqis who associate with other Islamic nationals, i.e. Saudis, Afghanis, Libyans, etc. Stakeout and surveillance of mosques will be stepped up. Briefing next week, TBA. Parisi, Captain, NYPD." I think I see a pattern here. Hard to believe, but it wasn't so long ago that we were trying to figure out what we were supposed to be doing every day, and memos were more carefully worded so as not to appear that we disapproved of Islamic terrorists or that we were upsetting them in any way. That changed real quick. The third email was from my wife, Kate Mayfield, whom I could see at her desk across the NYPD-FBI Great Divide of the 26th floor. My wife is a beautiful woman, but even if she weren't, I'd still love her. Actually, if she weren't beautiful, I wouldn't have even noticed her, so it's a moot point. The message read, "Let's knock off early. Go home, have sex. I'll cook you chili and hot dogs and make you drinks while you watch TV in your underwear." Actually, it didn't say that. It said, "Let's go away for a romantic weekend of wine tasting on the North Fork. I'll book a B&B. Love, Kate." Why the hell do I have to taste wine? It all tastes the same. Also, bed and breakfast places suck. Cutesy, run-down hovels with 19th-century bathrooms and creaky beds. And then you have to eat breakfast with the other guests, who are usually yuppie swine from the Upper West Side who want to talk about something they read in the Arts and Leisure section of the Times. Whenever I hear the word art, I reach for my gun. I typed my response. "Sounds great. Thanks for thinking of it. Love, John." Like most men, I'd rather face the muzzle of an assault rifle than a pissed-off wife. Kate Mayfield is an FBI agent, a lawyer, and part of my team, which consists of another NYPD guy and another FBI agent. Plus, now and then, we add a person or two from another agency, as needed, such as ICE or CIA. Our last CIA teammate was the aforementioned Ted Nash, whom I strongly suspect was once romantically involved with my then future wife. This was not why I disliked him. It was why I hated him. I disliked him for professional reasons. I noticed that Harry Muller was cleaning up his desk, locking away sensitive material so that the cleaning people, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, couldn't photocopy or fax it to Sandland. I said to him, "You got 21 minutes before the bell." He looked up at me and replied, "I have to go pick up some tech stuff." "Why?" "I told you. I'm doing a surveillance upstate. The Costa Hill Club." "I thought you were an invited guest." "No, I'm trespassing." "How did you catch this one?" "I don't know." "Do I ask?" "I own a camper, a pair of boots, and a hat with earmuffs. So, I'm qualified." "Right. Harry Muller, as I said, is former NYPD like me. Retired with 20 years in, the last 10 in the intelligence unit, and now hired by the feds to do stakeouts and surveillance so that the suits, as we call the FBI, can do the cerebral work." I asked him, "Hey, what's with this right-wing stuff? I thought you were with us." "Us," meaning the Mideast section, which makes up about 90% of the ATTF these days. Harry replied, "I don't know." "Do I ask? I just have to take pictures, not go to church with them." "Did you read the emails from Walsh and Parisi?"
"Yeah."
"You think we're going to war?"
Let me think.
"Does this right-wing group have any Iraqi or UBL connections?"
"I don't know."
Harry glanced at his watch and said, "I need to get to tech before they lock up."
"You got time."
I asked him, "You going alone?"
"Yeah, no problem.
It's just a non-evasive surveillance and stakeout." He looked at me and said, "Between us, Walsh says this is just killing trees. File building. You know, like, we're not just up the Arabs' asses. We're on the case of domestic groups, too, like the neo-Nazis, militia, survivalists, and stuff. Looks good for the media and Congress, if it ever comes up. Right? We did this a few times before 9/11. Remember?"
"Right.
Gotta go. I guess I'll see you Monday. I need to see Walsh first thing Monday."
"He's working Monday."
"Well, he didn't invite me to his house for a beer, so I guess he'll be here."
"Right.
See you Monday." Harry left. What Harry said about file building didn't make too much sense. Plus, we have a domestic terrorist section for that kind of stuff. Also, snooping on rich right-wingers with a club upstate was a little odd. Also odd was Tom Walsh coming in on a holiday to debrief Harry on a routine assignment. I'm very nosy, which is why I'm a great detective. So I went over to a separate, standalone computer where I could access the internet and did a Google search for Custer Hill Club. I didn't get any hits, so I tried Custer Hill. The counter at the top showed more than 400,000 hits, and the mix on the first page, golf courses, restaurants, and several historical references in South Dakota having to do with General George Armstrong Custer's problem at the Little Bighorn, indicated that none of these references would be relevant. Nevertheless, I spent 10 minutes scanning the hits, but there were no references to New York State. I went back to my desk, where I could use my ATTF password to access internal files on the ACS, the automated case system, the FBI's version of Google. The Custer Hill Club came up, but apparently I had no need to know about this file, and below the title was row after row of X's. Usually you get something, even on restricted files, such as the date the file was opened, or who to see about getting access to the file, or at least the classification level of the file. But this file was completely X'd out. So all I managed to do was alert the security goons that I'd been inquiring about a restricted file that had nothing to do with what I was working on, which was Iraqis at the moment. But just to mess with their heads, I typed in Iraqi Camel Club Weapons of Mass Destruction. No hits. I shut down my computer, secured my desk, grabbed my coat, and walked over to Kate's desk. Kate Mayfield and I met on the job when we both worked the case of the aforementioned Asad Khalil, a nasty little shit who came to America to kill a lot of people. He did that, then tried to kill me and Kate, then escaped. Not one of my better cases, but it brought Kate and me together, so the next time I see him, I'll thank him for that, before I gut shoot him and watch him die slowly. I asked Kate, "Can I buy you a drink?" She looked up at me and smiled. "That would be nice." Then went back to her computer. Ms. Mayfield is a Midwestern girl, posted to New York from Washington, and originally unhappy about the assignment, but now deliriously happy to live in the greatest city on earth with the greatest man in the universe. I asked her, "Why are we going away for the weekend?" "Because this place drives me crazy." Great cities can do that. I asked her, "What are you working on?"
"I'm trying to find a B&B on the North Fork."
"They're probably all booked up for the holiday weekend. And don't forget, I have to work Monday."
"How could I forget? You've been complaining about it all week."
"I never complain." She thought that was funny for some reason. I studied Kate's face in the glow of the computer screen. She was as beautiful as the day I met her nearly 3 years ago. Usually, women I'm with age fast. My first wife, Robin, said our one-year starter marriage seemed like 10 years. I said to Kate, "I'll meet you at Echo's."
"Don't get picked up."
I walked through the cube farm, which was nearly empty now, and entered the elevator lobby, where colleagues were piling up. I made small talk with a few people, then noticed Harry and went over to him. He was carrying a big metal suitcase, which I assumed contained cameras and lenses. I said to him, "Let me buy you a drink."
"Sorry, I need to get on the road ASAP.
"You driving up tonight?"
"I am. I need to be at this place at first light. Some kind of meeting going down, and I need to photograph car plates and people as they arrive."
"Sounds like the mob surveillance we used to do at weddings and funerals."
"Yeah, same shit."
We crowded into an elevator and rode down to the lobby. Harry asked, "Where's Kate?"
"On her way."
Harry was divorced, but he was seeing a woman, so I asked, "How's Laurie?"
"She's great.
She looked good in her photo on Match.com.
He laughed. "You're an asshole."
"What's your point?"
"Hey, where is this place?"
"What place?"
"Oh, it's up near Saranac Lake."
We walked out onto Broadway. It was a cool autumn day, and the streets and sidewalks had that thank God it's Friday feeling. Harry and I bid each other farewell, and I walked south on Broadway. Lower Manhattan is a tight cluster of skyscrapers and narrow streets, which ensures minimum sunlight and maximum stress. The area includes the Lower East Side, where I was born and raised, plus Chinatown, Little Italy, Tribeca, and Soho. The major industries down here are diametrically opposed. Business and finance, represented by Wall Street, and government, represented by federal, state, and municipal courthouses. City Hall, prisons, Federal Plaza, Police Plaza, and so forth. A necessary adjunct to all of the above are law firms, one of which employs my ex-wife, a defense attorney who represents only the best class of criminal scum. This was one of the reasons we got divorced. The other one was that she thought cooking and fucking were two cities in China. Up ahead was a big patch of empty sky where the Twin Towers once stood. To most Americans, and even to most New Yorkers, The absence of the towers is noted only as a gap in the distant skyline. But if you live or work downtown, and were used to seeing those behemoths every day, then their absence still comes as a surprise when you walk down the street, and they're not there. As I walked, I thought about my conversation with Harry Muller. On the one hand, there was absolutely nothing unusual or remarkable about his weekend assignment. On the other hand, it didn't compute. I mean, here we are, on the brink of war with Iraq, waging war in Afghanistan, paranoid about another Islamic terrorist attack, and Harry gets sent upstate to snoop on some gathering of rich right-wingers whose threat level to national security is probably somewhere between low and non-existent at the moment. And then there was Tom Walsh's nonsense to Harry about file building in case anyone in Congress or the media wanted to know if the ATTF was on top of the homegrown terrorists. This may have made sense a few years ago, but since 9/11, the neo-Nazis, militias, and that bunch have been quiet and actually thrilled that we got attacked and that the country was shaping up pretty good. Killing bad guys and arresting people and so forth. Then, there was the holiday Monday debriefing. Anyway, I shouldn't make too much of this, though it was a little odd. Basically, it is none of my business, and every time I ask too many questions about things that seem odd at 26 Federal Plaza, I get into trouble. Or, as my mother used to say, John, trouble is your middle name, and I believed her until I saw my birth certificate, which said Aloysius. I'll take trouble over Aloysius any day. Chapter 2 I turned onto Chambers Street and entered Echoes, an Italian restaurant with a saloon atmosphere. The best of both worlds. The bar was crowded with suited gentlemen and ladies in business attire. I recognized a lot of faces and said a few hellos. Even if I didn't know anybody there, being a good detective and an observer of New York life, I could pick out the high-paid attorneys, the civil servants, the law enforcement people, and the financial guys. I bump into my ex here sometimes, so one of us has to stop coming here. I ordered a Dewar's and soda and made small talk with a few people around me. Kate arrived, and I ordered her a white wine, which reminded me of my weekend problem. I asked, "Did you hear about the Great Blight?"
"What Great Blight?"
"The one on the North Fork. All the grapes are infected with this weird fungus that can be transmitted to human beings." She apparently didn't hear me and said, "I found us a nice B&B in Matatuck." She described the place based on some tourist website and informed me,
"It sounds really charming."
"So does Dracula's Castle on the Transylvanian website." I asked her, "Did you ever hear of the Custer Hill Club?"
"No."
"I didn't see it on the North Fork website.
What town is it in?"
"It's actually upstate New York."
"Oh, is it nice?"
"I don't know."
"Do you want to go there next weekend?"
"I'll check it out first." Apparently, this name didn't ring any bells with Ms. Mayfield, who sometimes knows things she doesn't share with me. I mean, we're married, but she's FBI, and I have a limited need to know and lower security clearance than she does. On that note, I wondered why Ms. Mayfield thought that the words Custer Hill Club referred to a place to stay, and not, for instance, a historical society, or a country club, or whatever. Maybe it was the context, or maybe she knew exactly what I was talking about. I changed the subject to the memos about Iraq, and we discussed the geopolitical situation for a while. It was Special Agent Mayfield's opinion that war with Iraq was not only inevitable, but also necessary. 26 Federal Plaza is an Orwellian ministry, and the government workers there are very attuned to any slight change in the party line. When political correctness was the order of the day, you would have thought the Anti-Terrorist Task Force was a social service agency for psychopaths with low self-esteem. Now, everyone talks about killing Islamic fundamentalists and winning the war on terror. Grammatical correctness would be the war on terrorism, but this is a newspeak word. Ms. Mayfield, a good government employee, has few politics of her own, so she has no problem hating the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and Osama bin Laden one day, then hating Saddam Hussein even more when a directive comes out telling her who to hate that day. But perhaps I'm not being fair. And I'm not totally rational on the subject of bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. I lost a lot of friends on 9/11, and but for the grace of God and heavy traffic, Kate and I would have been in the North Tower when it went down. I had been on my way to a breakfast meeting there in Windows on the World on the 107th floor. I was late, and Kate waited in the lobby for me. David Stein, Jack Koenig, and my former partner and maybe best friend in the world, Dom Finelli, were on time, as were a lot of other good people. And some bad people, like Ted Nash. No one in that restaurant survived. I don't get shaken up very easily. Even getting shot 3 times and nearly bleeding to death on a city street didn't have any lasting effect on my mental health, such as it is. But that day shook me up more than I realized at the time. I mean, I was standing right under the plane when it hit. And now, when I see a low-flying plane overhead, John? I turned to Kate.
What?
I asked you if you wanted another drink.
I looked down into my empty glass.
She ordered me another. I was vaguely aware that the news was on the TV at the end of the bar, and the reporter was covering the congressional vote on Iraq. Back in my head, it was 9/11 again. I had tried to make myself useful by helping the firemen and cops evacuate people from the lobby, and at the same time, I was searching for Kate. Then, I was outside the building, carrying a stretcher, and I happened to look up and see these people jumping from the windows. And I thought Kate was up there, and I thought I saw her falling. I glanced at her standing beside me, and she looked at me and asked, "What are you thinking about?" "Nothing." And then the second plane hit, and later I could hear this odd rumbling sound of collapsing concrete and steel, unlike anything I'd ever heard before, and I can still feel the ground shaking under my feet as the building fell, and shards of glass rained down from the sky. And like everyone else, I ran like hell. I still can't remember if I dropped the stretcher, or if the other guy dropped it first, or if I was actually carrying a stretcher at all. I don't think I'll ever remember. In the weeks following 9/11, Kate became withdrawn. Couldn't sleep, cried a lot, and rarely smiled. I was reminded of rape victims I'd dealt with who lost not only their innocence, but part of their soul. The sensitive bureaucrats in Washington urged anyone who'd been involved with this tragedy to seek counseling. I'm not the type to talk about my problems to strangers, professional or otherwise, but at Kate's insistence, I did go see one of the shrinks hired by the feds to handle the large demand. The guy was a little nuts himself, so we didn't make much progress in the first session. For my next session and subsequent sessions, I went to my neighborhood bar, Dresner's, where Aiden the bartender gave me sage counsel. "Life's a bitch," said Aiden. "Have another drink." Kate, on the other hand, stuck to her counseling for about 6 months, and she's much better now. But something had happened to her that was not going to completely heal. And whatever it was, it might have been for the better. Since I've known Kate, she has always been a good company girl, following the rules and rarely criticizing the Bureau or its methods. In fact, she used to criticize me for criticizing the Bureau. Outwardly, She's still a loyal soldier, as I said, and she goes along with the party line. But inwardly, since September 11th, she realizes that the party line has done a 180-degree turn, and this realization has made her a little more cynical, critical, and questioning. To me, this is a good thing, and we now have something in common. Sometimes I miss the starry-eyed team cheerleader I fell in love with, but I also like this tougher and more experienced woman who, like me, has seen the face of evil and is ready to meet it again. And now, a year and a month later, we are living in a state of perpetual color-coded anxiety. Today is alert level orange. Tomorrow? Who knows? For damn sure, it's not going to be green again in my lifetime. Part 2. Saturday. Upstate New York. It does not do to leave a dragon out of your calculations if you live near him. J.R.R. Tolkien. Chapter 3. Detective Harry Muller parked his camper on the side of an old logging road and gathered his gear from the front seat, then got out, checked his compass, and headed northwest through the woods, wearing an autumn camouflage outfit and a black knit cap. The terrain was easy to navigate, with well-spaced pine trees and ground cover of moss and dewy ferns. As he walked, daylight began filtering through the pines, revealing a thick ground mist. Birds sang, and small animals scurried through the undergrowth. It was cold, and Harry could see his breath, but the pristine forest was spectacular, so he was slightly more happy than miserable. Slung over his shoulders were binoculars, a handycam, and an expensive Nikon 12-megapixel camera with a long 300-millimeter lens. He also carried a Sibley guide to birds in case anyone asked him what he was doing there, and a 9mm Glock in case they didn't like his answer. He'd been briefed by a guy known as Ed from Tech, who'd told him that the Custer Hill Club property was about 4 miles long on each side, for a total of 16 square miles of private land. Incredibly, the entire property was enclosed within a high chain-link fence, which was why the tech guy had also handed him the wire cutters that Harry now carried in his side pocket. Within 10 minutes, he came to the fence. It was about 12 feet high and topped with razor wire. Metal signs about every 10 feet read, "Private property. Trespassers will be prosecuted." Another sign read, "Danger. Do not enter. Property patrolled by armed guards and dogs." From long experience, Harry knew that warning signs like these were usually more bullshit than reality. In this case, however, he'd take the signs seriously. Also, it troubled him that Walsh either didn't know about the dogs and armed guards, or knew and didn't tell him. In either case, he would have a few words for Tom Walsh on Monday morning. He took out his cell phone and switched it from ringer to vibrate. He noticed that his phone had good signal strength, which was a little strange up in the mountains. Impulsively, he dialed his girlfriend Lori's cell phone. After 5 rings, his call went into voicemail. Harry said softly into the phone, "Hi, babe. It's your one and only. I'm up here in the mountains, so maybe I won't have good reception for very long. But I wanted to say hi. I got up here last night about midnight, slept in the camper, and now I'm on duty, near the Right Wing Loony Lodge. So don't call back, but I'll call you later from a landline if I can't reach you by cell phone. Okay? I still need to do something at the local airport later today or tomorrow morning, so I might need to stay overnight. I'll let you know when I know. Speak to you later. Love you." He hung up, took the wire cutters, sliced a gap in the chain link, and squeezed through onto the property. He stood motionless, looked, listened, then put the wire cutters back in his pocket. He continued on through the woods. After about 5 minutes, he noticed a telephone pole rising between the pine trees, and he approached it. Mounted on the pole was a telephone call box, which was locked. He looked up and saw that the pole was about 30 feet high. Approximately 20 feet up the pole were 4 floodlights, and above that were 5 strands of wire running along a crossbeam. One wire obviously powered the telephone, and another powered the floodlights. The other 3 were actually thick cables that could carry lots of juice. Harry noticed something unusual and focused his binoculars toward the top of the pole. What he'd thought were evergreen boughs from surrounding trees were actually boughs protruding from the telephone pole. But these boughs, he knew, were the plastic kind that cell phone companies used to camouflage or beautify cell phone towers in populated areas. Why, he wondered, were they here in the middle of the woods? He lowered his binoculars, raised his Nikon, and snapped a few shots of the pole, recalling that Tom Walsh had said to him, "In addition to cars, faces, and plate numbers, photograph anything else that looks interesting." Harry thought this seemed interesting and good for the files, so he took his handy cam and shot 10 seconds of tape, then moved on. The terrain began to rise gradually, and the pines gave way to big oaks, elms, and maples whose remaining foliage were brilliant hues of red, orange, and yellow. A carpet of fallen leaves covered the ground, and they rustled when Harry passed over them. Harry did a quick map and compass check and determined that the lodge was straight ahead, less than 1/2 mile away. He broke out a breakfast bar and continued on, eating, enjoying the fresh Adirondack Mountain air while staying alert for trouble. Even though he was a federal agent, trespassing was trespassing, and without a warrant, he had no more right to be on private posted land than a poacher. And yet, when he'd asked Walsh about a warrant, Walsh had said to him, "We have no probable cause for surveillance." Why ask a judge if the answer is no? Or, as the NYPD like to say about bending the law, it's better to ask for forgiveness later than to ask for permission now. Harry, like everyone else in anti-terrorism, knew that the rules had changed about 2 minutes after the second tower had been hit, and the rules that hadn't changed could be broken. This usually made his job easier, but sometimes, like now, the job also got a little riskier. The forest had thinned out, and Harry noticed a lot of stumps where the trees had been felled and carted away, maybe for firewood, maybe for security. Whatever the reason, there was a lot less cover and concealment than there had been 100 yards back. Up ahead, he could see an open field, and he approached it slowly through the widely spaced trees. He stopped under the last standing maple and surveyed the open land with his binoculars. A paved road ran through the field and downhill to the entrance gate, where he could see a log cabin gatehouse through his binoculars. The road was lined with security lights mounted on metal poles, and he also noticed wooden telephone poles with 5 strands of wires coming out of the woods, crossing the field and road and disappearing again in the woods on the far side of the road. This, he assumed, was a continuation of what he'd seen near the fence, and it appeared that these poles and wires circled the property, meaning the whole 16-mile perimeter was floodlit. He said to himself, "This is not a hunting lodge." He scanned the road as it traveled uphill to a huge 2-story Adirondack-style mountain lodge that sat on the rising slope in front of him, about 200 yards away. On the front lawn of the lodge was a tall flagpole from which flew the American flag and, beneath that, some sort of yellow pennant. Beyond the lodge were some utility structures, and at the top of the hill was what looked like a radio or cell phone tower, and he took a telescopic photo of it with his Nikon. The lodge was made of river stone, logs, and wood shingles, with a big columned portico out front. The green shingled roof sprouted 6 stone chimneys, all of which billowed gray smoke into the air. He could see lights in the front windows and a black Jeep in the big gravel parking lot in front of the house. Obviously, someone was home, and hopefully they were expecting guests. That's why he was here. He used the Nikon to take a few telescopic photos of the parking lot and lodge. Then he turned on his handycam and took some establishing footage of the lodge and his surroundings. He knew that he'd have to get a lot closer if he was going to photograph arriving cars, people, and license plates. Ed from tech had shown him an aerial photo of the lodge and pointed out that the terrain was open, but that there were lots of large rock outcroppings for concealment. Harry looked at the outcroppings rising up the hill, and he planned his route to sprint from one rock formation to another until he could reach a vantage point about 100 feet from the lodge and the parking field. From there, he saw he could photograph and videotape parked cars and people going into the lodge. He needed to stay there until late afternoon, according to Walsh, then get over to the local airport to check out arriving passenger manifests and car rentals. He recalled the time he was on the case of a bunch of Irish Republican Army guys who'd set up a training camp not far from here. The Adirondack Forest Preserve was as big as the state of New Hampshire, a mixture of public and private land with a very small population, making it a good place to hunt, hike, and try out illegal weapons. This surveillance was a little different from the IRA bust, in that no crimes had apparently been committed, and the people who lived in that big lodge probably had some pull someplace. Harry was about to make his first rush toward an outcrop when suddenly 3 black jeeps appeared from behind the lodge and started traveling cross-country at high speed. In fact, they were traveling straight toward him.
Shit.
He turned and moved back into the tree line, then heard dogs barking in the forest.
Holy shit.
The 3 jeeps came right up to the trees, and 2 men exited from each vehicle. They carried hunting rifles. Out of the trees around him came 3 men with German shepherds straining at their leashes and growling. The men, he noticed, had sidearms strapped to their hips. Harry now saw a 4th guy coming out of the trees who walked as if he were in charge. Harry realized the only way his position could have been fixed so accurately was if there were motion or sound detectors planted in the area. These people really liked their privacy. He felt an unaccustomed sense of anxiety, though not fear. This was going to be messy, but not dangerous. The security guards had formed a circle around him but kept a distance of about 20 feet. They were all dressed in military-type camouflage fatigues with an American flag patch on their right shoulders. Each man wore a peaked cap with an American eagle on it, and each had a wireworm sprouting from his left ear. The man who was in charge, a tough-looking middle-aged guy, stepped closer, and Harry saw he had a military-type name tag that said Carl. Carl notified him, "Sir, you are on private property." Harry put on a dumb face.
"Are you sure?"
"Yes, sir."
"Oh, jeez.
Well, if you'll point the way. How did you get through the fence, sir?"
"Fence?
What fence?" "The fence that surrounds the property, sir, and is posted with no trespassing signs."
"I didn't see any—"
"Oh, that fence. Sorry, Carl, I was following a woodpecker. And he flew over, so I found a hole in the fence, and—"
"Why are you here?"
Harry noticed that Carl's tone had become a little less polite, and he'd forgotten the "sir" word. Harry replied, "I'm a bird watcher." He displayed his guidebook.
"I watch birds."
He tapped his binoculars.
"Why do you have those cameras?"
"I take pictures of the birds."
"Asshole.
So, if you'll point me to where I can exit the property, or better yet, drive me out, I'll be leaving." Carl didn't reply, and Harry sensed the first sign of possible trouble. Then Carl said, "There are millions of acres of public land around here. Why did you cut a hole in the fence?"
"I didn't cut any fucking hole, pal. I found a fucking hole. And by the way, Carl, fuck you."
Harry and everyone around him realized that he was not sounding like a birdwatcher any longer. He was about to flash his Fed creds, stand these bastards at attention, and tell them to give him a ride back to his camper. His second thought, however, was not to make a federal case of this. Why let them know he was a federal agent sent here to snoop? Walsh would have a total shit fit. Harry said, "I'm out of here." He took a step toward the forest. All of a sudden, rifles were raised and pistols came out of their holsters. The three dogs growled and pulled at their leashes. "Stop, or I'll let the dogs loose." Harry took a deep breath and stopped. Carl said, "There are two ways to do this, easy or hard." "Let's do hard." Carl glanced around at the other nine security guards, then at the dogs, then at Harry. He spoke in a conciliatory tone. "Sir, we are under strict instructions to bring any trespassers to the lodge, call the sheriff, and have the individual transported by a law enforcement person off the property. We will not press charges, but you will be advised by the sheriff that if you trespass again, you are subject to arrest. You may not, under the law or under our insurance policy, exit the land by yourself on foot, and we will not drive you off the land. Only the sheriff may do that. It's for your own safety." Harry thought about that. Though the assignment was belly up, he could pull out a little win by seeing the inside of the lodge, and maybe getting a little info there, and a little 411 from the local sheriff. He said to Carl, "Okay, sport, let's go." Carl motioned for Harry to turn and walk toward the jeeps. Harry assumed they'd put him in one of the vehicles, but they didn't, so maybe their insurance policy was real strict. The jeeps did stay with him, however, as he was directed to the road and up the hill toward the lodge, accompanied by the whole contingent. As he walked, he considered these 10 armed security guards with the dogs, the gatehouse, the chain-link fence, the razor wire, the floodlights and call boxes, and what were most likely motion and sound detectors. This was not your everyday hunting and fishing club. He was suddenly pissed off at Walsh, who'd barely briefed him, and more pissed at himself for not smelling trouble. He knew he shouldn't be frightened, but some instinct, sharpened by 20 years of police work and 5 years of anti-terrorist work, told him that there was an element of danger here. To confirm this, he said to Carl, who was walking behind him, "Hey, why don't you use your cell phone to call the sheriff now? Save some time." Carl didn't respond. Harry reached into his pocket. "You can use my cell phone." Carl snapped, "Keep your hands where I can see them and shut your fucking mouth." A cold chill ran down Harry Muller's spine. Chapter 4. Harry Muller sat across a desk from a tall, thin, middle-aged man who had introduced himself as Bain Maddox, president and owner of the Custer Hill Club. This, explained Mr. Maddox, was not his day job, only a hobby. Bain Maddox was also president and owner of Global Oil Corporation, GOCO for short, which Harry had heard of, and which also explained two of the photographs on the wall, one of an oil tanker and another of a burning oil field in some desert or another. Maddox noticed Harry's interest in the photographs and said, "Kuwait, the Gulf War." He added, "I hate to see good oil burning, especially if no one is paying me for it." Harry didn't reply. Mr. Maddox was wearing a blue blazer and a loud plaid shirt. Harry Muller was wearing his thermal long johns. He'd been subjected to a humiliating strip search by Carl and two other security guards, who had cattle prods and promised to use them if he resisted. Carl and one of those two guys stood behind him now, cattle prods in hand. So far, there was no sign of the sheriff, and Harry didn't think the sheriff was on the way. Harry watched Bane Maddox sitting quietly behind his big desk in the large, pine-paneled office on the second floor of the lodge. Through the window to his right, he could see the rising slope behind the lodge, and at the top of the hill, he noticed the tall antenna he'd seen from the woods. Mr. Maddox asked his guest, "Would you like some coffee? Tea?"
"Fuck you." "Is that a no?"
"Fuck you." Bane Maddox stared at Harry, and Harry stared back. Maddox looked about 60, Harry thought, very fit, unseasonably tanned, swept back gray hair, a long, thin, hooked nose like an eagle's, with gray eyes to match. Harry also thought this guy looked rich, but not stupid rich. There was something about Maddox that signaled strength, power, and intelligence. Command and control. And Maddox didn't seem one bit nervous about having abducted and detained a federal agent. This was not good, Harry knew. Maddox took a cigarette from a wooden box on his desk and asked, "Do you mind if I smoke?"
"I don't give a fuck if you burn. Call the sheriff. Now."
He lit the cigarette with a silver desk lighter and puffed thoughtfully, then asked, "What brings you here, Detective Muller?"
"Bird watching."
"I don't mean to be rude, but that seems like a sissy hobby for a man involved in anti-terrorism."
"You're about 1 minute away from me placing you under arrest."
"Well then, let me use that minute wisely." Maddox examined the items strewn across the desk. Harry's cell phone and pager, which were now shut off, his keychain, the handycam, the Nikon digital camera, the binoculars, the Sibley bird guide, a terrain map of the area, the compass, the wire cutters, Harry's credentials, and his 9mm Glock 26, the so-called baby Glock that was easier to conceal. He noticed that Maddox had removed the magazine, which was smart of him. Maddox asked Harry, "What am I to make of this?"
"Whatever the fuck you want to make of it, pal. Give me my shit and let me the fuck out of here, or you'll be looking at 20 years to life for kidnapping a federal agent."
Maddox made a face, suggesting he was annoyed and impatient.
"Come on, Mr. Muller. We're well beyond that by now. We need to move forward."
"Fuck you." Maddox suggested, "Let me play detective. I see here a pair of binoculars, a small video camera, a very expensive digital camera with a telescopic lens, and a bird guide. From that, I can conclude that you are an enthusiastic bird watcher. So enthusiastic, in fact, that you also have these wire cutters in the event a fence comes between you and a bird. Plus, a 9mm handgun in case a bird won't stay still long enough for you to photograph it." He asked Harry, "How am I doing?"
"Not too good."
"Let me keep trying. I also see here a U.S. Geological Survey map on which is drawn in red the perimeter of my property, plus the gatehouse, and this lodge and other structures. This suggests to me that an aerial photograph was taken of my property, and these man-made features were transferred to your map. Correct?" Harry didn't answer. Mr. Maddox continued, "I also see here on my desk this badge and a card that identifies you as a retired New York City police detective. Congratulations."
"Eat shit and die.
But what interests me most is this other badge and ID card that say you are a federal agent with the Anti-Terrorist Task Force. Not retired." He stared at the photo ID, then at Harry Muller, and asked, "Working today?" Harry decided to try the cover story one more time, just in case this guy wanted a reason to cut him loose. Okay, let me tell you again what I told you paranoid rent-a-cops. I'm up here for the weekend camping. I watch and photograph birds. I'm also a federal agent, and by law I have to carry my credentials and my piece. You shouldn't put two and two together and come up with five. Understand? Maddox nodded. I do. But put yourself in my position, and I'll put myself in yours. I'm Federal Agent Harry Muller, and I'm listening to a man who tells me that all the circumstantial evidence I see in front of me, evidence of surveillance, can be explained as bird watching. So, do I let you go? Or do I demand a more logical and truthful explanation? What would you do in my position? Sorry, I can't hear you over your loud shirt. Mr. Maddox smiled, then opened the Sibley guide, put on his eyeglasses, and selected a page. He asked Harry, "Where are you most likely to encounter a loon, Mr. Muller?" "Near a lake." That was too easy. He flipped a few pages. "What is the color of a cerulean warbler?" "Brown." Mr. Maddox shook his head. "No, no, Mr. Muller. Cerulean means blue. Sky blue. One more. 2 out of 3 is passing." He flipped through the book again. "What color is the male..." "Hey, take that book. Put a coat of KY jelly on it and shove it up your ass." Mr. Maddox closed the guide and threw it aside. He turned to his computer screen. "Here are your digital photos. I don't see any birds in them. I see, however, that you seem interested in one of my utility poles. And let's see. Here's a telescopic shot of the tower behind my lodge. Close-ups of my lodge. Ah, there's a bird perched on my roof. What is that?" "A shit-seeking hawk." Maddox picked up the handycam, switched it to replay, and looked through the viewfinder. "Here's the pole again. You notice the plastic boughs, I assume. Here's the lodge again. Nice views from where you were standing. That bird is flying away. What was that? Looks like a great blue heron, but he should have migrated south by now. It's been unusually warm this fall. Global warming, if you believe that crap." He put down the camcorder and asked, "Do you know what the solution is to global warming?" "No? I'll tell you. Nuclear winter." He laughed. "Old joke." Maddox sat back in his chair and lit another cigarette. He blew perfect smoke rings and watched them as they rose and dissolved. "That's a lost art." Harry Muller glanced around the room as Bane Maddox practiced his lost art. He could hear the breathing of the two men behind him as he shifted his gaze to a wall that was covered with framed certificates of some sort. Harry thought that if he could get a handle on who this guy was, it might be helpful. Maddox noticed Harry's gaze and said, "The one on the top left is my certificate for the Silver Star. Next to it is the certificate for the Bronze Star, then the Purple Heart. Then there's my commission as a second lieutenant in the United States Army. Next row are the usual service medals, including the Vietnam Campaign Medal and a Presidential Unit Citation. I served in the 7th Cavalry Regiment of the 1st Air Cavalry Division. The 7th Cav was General Custer's old unit. That's part of the reason for the name of this club. I might tell you the other part later, but if I do, then I'll have to kill you." He laughed. "Just joking." "Hey, smile. Just joking." Harry forced a smile. "Asshole." "The last row is the combat infantry badge, my expert rifleman badge, my jungle training school diploma, and, finally, my army discharge. I left the service after 8 years with the rank of lieutenant colonel. We made rank fast in those days. Lots of dead officers opened up the promotion list. Did you serve?
No.
Harry decided to play along. I was too young. Then they ended the draft.
Right. They should bring it back.
Absolutely, Harry said. They should draft women, too. They want equal rights. They should have equal responsibilities.
You're absolutely right.
Harry was on a roll and continued. My son still had to register for the draft in case they ever bring it back. But my daughter didn't. What's that all about?
Precisely. You have a son and daughter?
Yeah.
Married?
Divorced, Harry replied.
Me too.
Women will drive you crazy, Harry said.
Only if you let them.
Well, we let them.
Maddox chuckled.
We do. Anyway, you're here on surveillance for the Federal Anti-Terrorist Task Force.
Why?
How long were you in Vietnam?
Maddox looked at Harry Muller for a few seconds, then replied, 2 tours of 1 year each, then a third tour that was cut short by an AK-47 round that missed my heart by an inch, nicked my right lung, and broke a rib on the way out.
You're lucky to be alive.
I tell myself that every day. Each day is a gift. Have you ever been shot at?
5 times.
Never got hit.
You're lucky to be alive.
Maddox stared at Harry.
It changes you.
You're never the same again. But it's not necessarily for the worse.
I know. I've got friends who've been hit.
He thought of John Corey, but he was fairly sure that Corey was the same wise ass both before and after getting hit. He said,
Sometimes, I think I should have volunteered.
Vietnam was over, but I could have still served. Maybe I would have caught the Grenada invasion or something.
Well, don't be hard on yourself. Most American men have never served. And to tell you the truth, war is a damn scary thing. And now we're engaged in this war on terrorism. And you, Mr. Muller, are apparently on the front lines. Correct?
Yeah.
And by terrorism, we generally mean Islamic terrorists. Correct?
Yeah, but...
So, are you looking for Islamic terrorists here? Can I help? Harry was forming a thought, but Mr. Maddox went on.
If there's anything I can do, Mr. Muller, just let me know. There's no one who feels more strongly about winning the war on terrorism than I.
How can I help?
Well, here's the thing. About 5 years ago, I was on this case of Irish Republican Army guys. Terrorists. Only about 15 miles from here. They had a training camp.
Harry filled in Maddox on the case and concluded, We sent 8 guys to federal prison for terms ranging from 3 to 20 years.
Ah, yes. I remember that because it was so close to here.
Right. So this is the same thing. We're checking a lot of private preserves to see if there's any suspicious activity involving the IRA. We've had intelligence reports that...
So this has nothing to do with Islamic terrorists?
No, not today. We're doing IRA.
Seems like a waste of time and resources in light of 9/11.
Well, I think so too. But we need to keep on top of everything and everybody.
I suppose.
Maddox thought a moment, then asked, So, you think the Custer Hill Club is,
what,
a training camp for the Irish Republican Army?
Well, the bosses had a tip about activity in this area, so I got picked to take a peek.
You know, in case people were using your property without you knowing.
No one can enter my property without me knowing, as you just found out.
Yeah, I see that. I'll report, certainly not people engaged in paramilitary training.
Yeah, I...
And that doesn't explain why you were taking pictures of my lodge. You should be out in the woods looking for these IRA people.
Yeah,
I got turned around.
You certainly did. The point is, you are on surveillance.
Well, yeah.
I need to check about a dozen properties in the area.
I see. So I shouldn't feel singularly honored?
Huh?
I shouldn't feel picked on?
No, just routine stuff.
That's a relief. By the way, do you have any sort of government warrant for these activities?
I do, but not with me.
Aren't you supposed to carry the warrant with you? He waved his hand over the desk and said,
We didn't find anything, even when we looked up your rectum.
Mr. Maddox smiled.
Hey, fuck you. Fuck you!